Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am James Fang, your quarterly chairman. I would also like to welcome the listeners of radio station WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, one of over 200 stations nationwide who are carrying this program. And now, today's speaker. Like a refreshing Rocky Mountain breeze, our speaker this afternoon has exhilarated millions of people throughout the world with his tremendous musical talent and commitment to making our world a better place to live. Our speaker today is the internationally acclaimed songwriter, performer, actor, and activist, John Denver. Blending his musical gift and a down-to-earth style, John Denver has carved out a career as one of the music industry's premier artists. In addition to 14 gold albums and 8 platinum albums, John Denver songs such as Take Me Home, Country Roads, Rocky Mountain High, and Thank God I'm a Country Boy have come to symbolize the American experience. Yet along with his commercial and musical success, John Denver has also accepted the social responsibility that comes with celebrity status. He's involved extensively with environmental concerns and is co-founder of the WinStar Foundation, a nonprofit environmental education and research center. In addition, he has applied his efforts toward ending world hunger by also helping to co-found the Hunger Project and receiving the prestigious Presidential World Without Hunger Award. But our speaker today has not limited himself to land issues. John Denver has taken an active interest in flying and space exploration. He has been awarded a public service medal by NASA for helping increase the awareness of space exploration throughout the world. He is married to Australian actress Cassandra Delaney. Here to talk to us on the topic of space and the environment, in a speech entitled Environmental High, the Commonwealth Club of California warmly and proudly welcomes Mr. John Denver.
Thank you very much, James, Ms. Auer, ladies and gentlemen. It's a real honor to be here and a great privilege to me to have the opportunity to speak to you. I am known primarily around the world as a singer. I promise you that I sing much better than I talk, and yet it is something that I enjoy doing, sharing my feelings, my opinions, my vision, if you will, for the world that we live in with every opportunity that I have. And this is a very, very special pleasure to me. Speaking after lunch, I think, is dangerous. I was at church with my mother on Mother's Day, and the preacher began his sermon by saying that his job that morning was to speak to you, as is mine today, and your job was to listen, and that if you finished your job before I finish mine, please leave quietly so as not to disturb or awaken the person next to you. I hope it won't quite be like that, but you never know. Space and the environment might seem like a contradiction in terms to you, and I would like to tell you how they tie together for me. I would like to, in the process, tell you a little bit about myself, how I got to be where I am in the world, and whatever that is, what it means to me, and what I would like to do with this very unique situation that I find myself in. It was mentioned that I'm internationally known as a singer and a songwriter. To be truthful, I have yet to go anywhere in the world and not be recognized. I find that a very, very unique situation for an individual like myself. Whether it's a slum in India, a village in Africa, a commune in China, or a village in the Soviet Union. Everywhere I'm recognized. To have little kids in a slum, the largest slum in the world on the outskirts of Bombay, India, following me around saying, John Denver, saying Country Roads. I think that's an amazing situation and fairly unique as far as I can tell, and also an enormous opportunity in my life. And that's part of what I want to talk to you about around space and the environment, is the opportunity that is before us and the responsibility that we have, in my opinion, to live up to that opportunity, to that possibility, not the probability. If you look at the probabilities in the world today, I think they're on a very negative kind of spiral, and I prefer to live in a world of possibility and think about what can be done and how I as an individual, how any of us can make a difference. I believe that we're at a critical time in the history of life on planet Earth, that we are making decisions today and taking actions will affect not only our lives, but the lives of all future generations, and in fact, the potential for life on this planet. Depending on who you talk to, and the people that I listen to and talk to, say that in the next 10 years, in this decade, we will determine, you and I, whether or not this Earth remains inhabitable by human beings, by higher life forms. We are the endangered species, folks, and we're not getting it. And more importantly, we are not passing it on to our young people. I believe that the greatest challenge that faces us in the world today is to give our young people, the generation that follows us, a vision of possibility in their lives. I believe that they have none. I believe that that is why we have the highest suicide rate of teenagers in history. I believe that that is why we have the drug problems, the crime problems that we have in our country and around the world, because we have young people who have no sense of a better world out there, a better way of life, a better quality of life. And without that vision, there's certainly going to be no commitment on their part to make it become a reality. I was talking with Ms. Auer when I first sat down, and she said to me that the most important thing in life, in her opinion, was to have some values and that you make a commitment to making a contribution. I believe that too. I believe that there comes a point in each of our lives when the world becomes larger than ourselves and that we have to begin living in that world. We have to give something of ourselves to a larger life. So, for me, I'm an Air Force brat. I was born in Roswell, New Mexico. My father was raised on a small family farm in Oklahoma. And I lived in a lot of different places, and I was very shy as a child. I was very insecure, I feel. If you listen to the words of John Bradshaw, and by the way, there's some homework for you folks while I'm thinking of it. I'd like to suggest that you take a look at Mr. Bradshaw's work. I'd like to suggest that you read Robert Bly's Iron John and find out about how we used to teach our young people. And for Mr. Bradshaw, how there is an inner child in each one of us that is probably abused, that we probably all came from dysfunctional families. I'd like you to read the work of Marjorie Paul, a book called Healing Your Aloneness, which is about inner bonding. And perhaps you'll remember those. They have had a profound effect on my life. But back to my life. When I moved around at all the different places my father was transferred, I had this guitar that my grandmother gave me when I was 12 years old. And this guitar, I spent a lot of time with that guitar, and it helped me make friends. When I went to a junior high school, I'd graduated from junior high school in Tucson, Arizona, where it was only 2 years, and high school was 4 years. And I started school in Montgomery, Alabama, a week after everybody else had started, not knowing a single person. And I remember starting class, my homeroom teacher was a civics instructor, and she asked me if I was an American citizen, because so many people came through that air base, Maxwell Air Force Base, from other countries. And I can't tell you how lost and alone I felt. And what I always had for solace, though, was this guitar. And it helped me to make friends. I was in chorus class all the time instead of being in study hall. And when people asked me why I chose to take chorus class, I said, but I write songs. I love music. And then pretty soon they'd ask me to bring a guitar to class, as happened in this case, and I'd sing a couple of songs that I'd written, and pretty soon people were starting to say hello to me in the halls. And I wasn't so alone anymore. I remember once two things that happened when I was 12 years old. In part, all of these travels and having the guitar, spending a lot of time on my own, I also spent a lot of time out of doors. I am a tree hugger. There was not a tree anywhere that I couldn't climb. And I loved getting out in the desert when we lived in Arizona. I loved getting in the woods. And again, not spending too much time with people, spending time on my own. And so for me, because nature had such a profound effect on my life, and because when I started to find a way to communicate, to articulate the feelings that I had, it was perfectly natural for me that I take so many images from nature. And I think that that's one of the things that has helped make my music so universally popular around the world. There are places where they call me the voice of America. I appreciated what you said, James. And it's something that I have tried to live up to. 12 years old, two things happened. One has to do with space, and one the environment. I was on the small farm that my father was raised on, and I was laying in a field outside after dark, and for the first time, at least to my knowledge, became aware of the stars and wondered what that was out there and what does that have to do with my life? Because obviously, for me, there was some connection. There was something that had to do with the heavens that has to do with me, and I began wondering about that. I also, at that time, was in a tree one of many times. And I had a dream, a vision, if you will, that someday I was going to have a place in the mountains that people were going to come to from all over the world, that I would have friends somehow all over the world, and they would come to this place, and whether I was there or not, they would meet people who were like themselves, and they would have an opportunity to talk with those people about the things that they cared and believed in. And in doing so, they would find that they had a great deal in common. And they would come away from this place rested and rejuvenated and strengthened. And they would be able to go back to whatever it was they were doing in the world, uplifted with a new sense of commitment to being part of creating a better quality of life, and that they would know they were not alone, which is how I so often felt at that time in my life. And what has happened for me through the years in writing these songs and finding out how to express my deepest feelings is that I've found that there are people all over the world who feel the same way as I do, and that I'm not alone. And the excitement for me in being here today and the reason that I keep working as hard as I do, both in singing and in speaking when I can about the environment or at a situation like this, is because I hope that somewhere in me and what I have to do and what I have to say will be like a little spark that will light a candle for you, and that it will move you to do something that you had perhaps not imagined you could do, to find a way that you can make a difference and be part of creating a better quality of life for all living things. That dream about a place in the mountains never disappeared. And back in 1974-75, when things were really going great for me, I was traveling around the world. I had a friend named Tom Crum, who was my security man. And we talked about all the things that we thought was going on in the world and what we could do about them and what we aspired to. And I realized that this dream that I'd had all my life, it was time to do something about it or quit talking about it. And I was in a position to be able to do something, and that was to create the Windstar Foundation. The purpose of the Windstar Foundation is to be a catalyst for responsible action, for a healthy environment, and a sustainable future. If I am able to live up to my greatest dreams, it will be to be that kind of catalyst. And that is what I hope to do today. As one who found so much in nature, as I continued my growth and evolution, I began to notice that there were a lot of problems out there in the world. And there were things, there was a direction that we were going in some ways that I thought created grave problems for our future. And I wanted to know what to do about that and how I could make this dream be a part of the solution of those problems. This, too, was a part of getting Windstar founded. At the same time, the stars out there always held me. My father being a pilot, the incredible experience of flying and wanting to fly and wanting to fly in space. And I still want to fly in space. Now, you may have heard... Did you hear about the guy in Nebraska who started raising money to give me a one-way ticket into space? You know, the story broke that that NASA had turned me down, and that the Soviets that I had offered the Soviets $10 million to fly in space. So I want to set you straight about that story. All right? The reason for that is I want to tell you why I wanted to fly in space, and it has to do with the space and the environment. I believe that we face a lot of problems in the world, folks. We have a national debt that I don't know how we're going to handle. We have cities and states going into bankruptcy. We have hunger. We have some just grave, serious, terrible problems out there. And they're not all about the environment, but to me, they're all connected to the environment. And I truly believe that the most important one that we have to deal with is the environment, that we truly are the endangered species. And I've gotten involved in so many issues, hunger, the resolution of conflict, energy resources, all of these things, education, economics, are all connected to the environment for me. And I think that space is one of the ways for us to deal with the environment. Now, do you remember the movie I made, Oh God? So I want to tell you why I made that movie. I had gotten to a point in my career where the opportunity was there, available, for me to make a film. But I didn't want to just make a film. I wanted to find one that would also be an expression of what I'm trying to do with my life and with my music. And all of a sudden, out of all these scripts, this funny little story called Oh God came across my desk. And there was one scene in there, which you may remember, which was the catalyst for me doing that film. It's where God first sees Jerry, or Jerry sees God face to face in the bathroom. And he asks God, why did he pick this particular time to make an appearance? And God says, well, I made the world to work. And Jerry says, well, have you read the paper lately? It ain't working. And God says, I know, I can see that. He says, you're filling the rivers with filth, the skies with pollution. He says, you're killing all my fishes. He says, you want a miracle, make a fish. And Jerry says, well, why don't you do something about it? And God says, why don't you do something about it? It's your world. Well, boy, a light went off in my head, because I believe if we're going to deal with the problems that confront us, it's going to be us working together. We cannot depend on divine intervention. And Jerry said, but we need help. And God says, that's why I gave you each other. See, I believe that we're here for each other, not against each other. And it's just a hard lesson to learn. You know, it's taken a long time for us to get to this particular place. I think the world has always been about you or me, which means me first. But I believe that today we live in a world where we have to recognize that there is a shift in consciousness taking place. And what that is to a world of you and me. And if this is the last barrel of oil or the last bushel of wheat, I have a better chance of surviving by sharing it with you than by trying to keep it from you. We must begin to think and act like a global community. And we must instill in our young people that possibility and a commitment to making that the realization. So, I wanted to fly on a space shuttle. And I still do. I realized that I couldn't wait to be invited. So I called then-Administrator of NASA, James Beggs, and I said, Dr. Beggs, I'd like to fly in space. Oh, that's very interesting, Mr. Denver. And I said, well, do you have a few minutes? I'd like to talk to you about it. Yes. So I said, I believe that NASA is in trouble, the same kind of trouble they're in today. I believe that NASA doesn't have the budget to do a quarter of what you're capable of doing or would like to do. And you don't have that support because you don't have the understanding and support of our elected officials in government. And you don't have it there because you really don't have the understanding and support of the American people. And you need to do something about that. Where you have failed miserably is in marketing yourself and letting people know what you have accomplished and how much has come to be a part of our lives that came out of our space effort. And I believe the way to do that is to have a civilian fly in space, and especially someone like me. And I gave him a bunch of credentials, you know, this is how I'm known around the world, the records that I've sold, the awards that I've been given, more importantly, the 6 landings I have in the shuttle simulator, being on expeditions with Jacques Cousteau, being an amateur astronomer, and above all, hopefully in my music and sometimes when I'm articulate enough to be a communicator. And I think that that's what NASA needs. And out of all of that, the whole Citizen Space Program got started. And I was guaranteed a flight by Dr. Beggs. In fact, I thought I was going to be on the first flight until President Reagan announced that he wanted to send a teacher first. And I remind you of Krista McAuliffe and what she wanted to do in space about education for young people. So out of all of that, you heard that I received NASA's Public Service Award. Everywhere I go in the world, I talk about space and how exciting it is and that there's a frontier there for us and all of the gains that we can get. The fact that when people ask, why do we spend so much money putting a man on the moon, that there was a $7 return for every dollar we invested in that effort in 1970s dollars. That this whole age of information that we're involved in right now is a product of our space effort and technology that came from space. I was dismayed to read a couple of days ago of all the organizations and scientists who said we don't want a space station because I think that that's where our future lies. And this is why, not what you may think. The reason I wanted to fly in space is I wanted to go up there and talk to young people. I wanted to produce a television show called The State of Our Planet. And as I journeyed around in space, I would host this 3-hour-long television show, and we would go down to this region of the world, and there would be a lot of pre-produced elements, and there would be some live things going on everywhere we beamed down to, and that what we would talk about is in this region of the world, this is our history, this is our heritage, this is our culture. These are the problems we face now in the 1990s, and this is our commitment to the next century. And I believe as we went around the world that you would find that everybody in the incredible diversity of life and heritage and culture, the richness of humanity, that we would find that we all have the same problems and that we all have the same kind of commitment to a better world, a better way of life. And I believe that although the Super Bowl has been broadcast around the world, that we have yet to have an experience of global community, something going on right now that connects us all over the world. And I believe that this would be a magical, magical television show. We would talk about the state of our planet, who we are as human beings. And I think within that and with the involvement of young people and letting young people know that they're still, although it's getting very close to a critical point in my perception, that there is still the possibility for us to create the world that we have dreamed of since the beginning of time, a world of peace, of prosperity, a world where all human beings have the opportunity to live a fulfilling life, to make a contribution. I believe that that's still possible, and I believe that each one of us aspires to that. And what I'm looking for is how, you know, at Windstar we say to be a purpose, a catalyst for responsible action. I think one of the major problems is what does it take to get people to act? We know what the problems are. To a large degree, we know the solution to these problems. But we are so slow to act. We're so slow to take responsibility. A lot of the things that are going on in the world are because we didn't know any better. But we know better now, and we've got to withdraw from greed, from concern about profit margins. We have to do whatever it takes to get the world back in balance. And a big part of that, in my opinion, is finding out how to communicate to these young people, to get them involved, to get them to participate, to get them to have the true sense that there is a world of possibility out there. And it's not going downhill, but the only way that it's going to get back on track is what you do as an individual. You make a difference. You make a difference by what you do. You make a difference by what you don't do. And it's your commitment to making a difference that will create a different world. And I believe we have our work cut out for us, folks, to get to people, to do that. And I still think that this flight in space is one way to do it. I think that it would get an enormous amount of attention. And I think it would be a great way to speak to young people all over the world. And I still volunteer. I do, man. I had given up on this. I actually had a flight scheduled. The Soviets invited me to fly. All right? And because I had talked with them, as I had talked with the folks at NASA, where I had an enormous amount of support to fly, about what I wanted to do and what it was for, about getting to young people and getting their interest back in the future and in technology and taking advantage of what is called in your program the final frontier, being a part of conquering space. Even if you're going to be a janitor in the space station or an accountant, we're going to need all of those folks up there. And from that perspective, we can see more than ever before and to much greater detail than ever before what is going on here on the planet. At WinStar, one of the things we've created is the Aspen Global Change Institute. Boy, is this clock correct? Goes awfully fast. I was worried about not talking long enough. Does the radio station stay? Because there are a couple of things I want to leave for the radio audience. They'll stay too? Can I talk longer, Gene? The Aspen Global Change Institute is a product of WinStar, and we're bringing Earth scientists from all over the world to Aspen for 6 weeks in the summer, not to a convention just to deliver a paper and leave, but to come and sit and talk, each from their area of discipline, and figure out what really is going on in regard to global change and what human impact is having on those changes, what kinds of things need to be done so that we can get that information to the policymakers like the current administration so they'll quit saying we don't know enough to take such severe and strong actions. They will know enough, folks, within the next couple of years. And also, unprecedented, we're bringing educators to these 6-week-long conferences in Aspen so that we can create a curriculum to get out there into grade schools and junior and high schools all over this country and eventually around the world to begin creating in young people an ethic, an environmental ethic. Along with that, the United Nations Environment Program and NASA have created a program called Ground Truth. And what we're going to do is have field trips for young people in schools to go out and to verify what the satellites are telling us. And we think this is a very, very exciting way to get young people involved, to recognize, you know, the excitement of what's going on technologically, what it has to do with us, and what it has to do with them and their future. Very, very exciting stuff to me. Amway is a major corporate sponsor for the Aspen Global Change Institute. We're looking for more sponsors. I think environmental education is of critical importance in our world. And again, a way to get young people. You know, how much excitement was there yesterday about this eclipse? Did you all see it, any part of it? I really hated not being in Hawaii or down in Baja. I wanted to see a total eclipse. But great excitement all over our country about this. Filled the newspapers. We all, each one of us, in my opinion, are the same as human beings. You know, we say that children are the same all over the world. Of course they are. The birth cry of every newborn baby is the same. But we're not so quick to say that people are the same, that parents are the same, grandparents are the same, lovers are the same. You know, I believe that we are, and my travels all over the world has only strengthened that conviction. No matter what language you speak, no matter what color your skin, no matter the expression of your faith or the form of your politics, we are all human beings. We are part of the human family, and we are in this together. And we have to begin working together in every way that we can imagine to create a sustainable future and a healthy environment. And the most important part of that in my mind is how do we get to the young people? And that for me is the preventive measure, if you will. I will continue to try to do that with my music, with my life in every way that I can, and somehow I've gotten back on this space kick. Folks, I had a flight scheduled with the Soviets a year and a half ago, and found out that my wife, Cassandra, was pregnant. And I let go of that flight to be with her during her pregnancy and to deliver our baby rather than be over the Soviet Union in training. And I don't know if it's going to come back for me again, either that opportunity or one here with NASA. I've talked about this a couple times in the last couple of months to people and started to generate some excitement about it, mostly in my own heart. And so I'm going to see if it's not something that can still happen. I think it would still be of enormous value. Some experience of us as a global community and in a way that really gives children, our young people, a vision for a brighter and better future. There are 10,000 more things I wanted to say. I wanted to leave you with a couple of poems, if I may, before I answer some questions. The first poem is a poem about preventive measures, and it's one that I found in my chiropractor's office. Perfect, huh? This is the story of the ambulance down in the valley. 'Twas a dangerous cliff, as they freely confessed, though to walk near its edge was quite pleasant, till over the side slipped a duke and a prince, and it had fooled many a peasant. The people all said something had to be done, though their projects did not at all tally. Some said put a fence round the edge of the cliff, others an ambulance down in the valley. The lament of the crowd was profound and so loud as their hearts overflowed with great pity, but the ambulance carried the cry of the day as it spread to the neighboring cities. A collection was made to accumulate aid, and dwellers in highway and alley gave dollars and cents not to furnish a fence, but an ambulance down in the valley. For the cliff is all right if you're careful, they said, and if folks ever trip and are falling, it's not the slipping and sliding that hurts so much as the shock when they're stopping. And so on for years as these mishaps occurred, quick forth would the rescuer sally to pick up the victims who fell from the cliff with the ambulance down in the valley. Said one in his plea, "It's a marvel to me that you'd give so much greater attention to repairing results than to curing the cause. Why, you'd much better aim at prevention. The mischief, of course, should be stopped at its source. Come, friends and good neighbors, let's rally. It makes far better sense to rely on a fence than an ambulance down in the valley." "He's wrong in his head," the majority said. "He would end all our earnest endeavors. He's the kind of a jerk that would halt our good work, but we will support it forever. Don't we pick up them all just as quick as they fall and treat them with care quite liberally? A superfluous fence is of no consequence if the ambulance works in the valley." Well, the story is queer as I've given it here, though things oft occur which are stranger. More humane, we assert, to repair all the hurt than the plan of removing the danger. Before it all ends, it's time to begin to attend to these things rationally. Yes, build up the fence and let us dispense with the ambulance down in the valley. Preventive measures. You know, we're liable to end up where we're headed unless we can somehow bring ourselves with a greater sense of commitment and responsibility, and just as importantly, more importantly, our young people into this world and recognizing that it's their world and that it will be the way they want it. And it can be a world far beyond anything that we've ever imagined. A friend of mine, Edgar Kaiser Jr., as a matter of fact, who heard I was going to speak here, and I told him what I wanted to talk about, gave me this poem. "The old man going the lone highway came at evening, old and gray, to a chasm, vast, deep, and wide. The old man paused in the twilight dim. The sullen stream had no fear for him, and built a bridge to span the tide. Good friend, said a fellow pilgrim near, why waste your time with your building here? Your journey will end with the ending day. You'll never again pass this way. Why built'st this bridge at evening tide? The builder lifted his old gray head. "Good friend, in the path I have come," he said, "there followest after me the youth whose feet must pass this way. This chasm, which has been naught to me, to that fair-head youth may a pitfall be. He too must cross in the twilight dim. Good friend, I am building this bridge for him." Thank you very much, folks.
Thank you, John Denver, for your passionate remarks. And now, Gene Auer, president of the Commonwealth Club of California, will conduct the question and answer portion of our program.
Thank you, James Fang, quarterly chairman. Mr. Denver, we do have a number of questions for you, and I'll just add a comment. I'm glad you have a chiropractor. The first question is, where is your guitar?
Well... You know, I had thought about doing a song here. As I said, I sing much better than I speak, and I was concerned about the time, and then I got real nervous when you said, "I hope you have 30 minutes at least," and then all of a sudden it was 5 till. So it's down at the Circle Star Theater. I'm performing there last night and tonight, and then off to Saskatchewan, James, tomorrow. And I'm sorry I didn't bring it. I'd love to have sung for you.
You can always go see him this evening at the Circle Star Theater. Do you plan to release any more records soon?
I have a new album we just recorded this spring that is coming out in September. It's called Different Directions, and there are some wonderful things on it. One of the things is a bluegrass symphony, which is another contradiction in terms, like space and the environment, a bluegrass symphony that I've been working on for years, and it's a nine-minute piece of music. It's called Foxfire Suite. And there are three movements and then a reprise of the first. And I'm not supposed to say this, but Itzhak Perlman is playing fiddle on it.
Can you mention a few other performers who are making a significant social impact as well?
Well, I think more and more people are, once again, coming out and taking a stand on certain issues. Folks that I admire, the people from Cheers, Ted Danson and what he's doing. Whoopi Goldberg is... been a very, very strong activist in many things. Billy Crystal, Robin Williams, the work they're doing for homeless people in our country. Quite often it seems like, as it seemed to me, the We Are the World effort was a bunch of people getting on a bandwagon because there was an issue that had a lot of attention right then, and then they're gone. And I have much, I have a great appreciation for those who do whatever they can to bring some of these things to the public attention, and that's certainly enough, you know, to do that with your celebrity. But I have so much regard and respect for those people who are into it for the long haul and who aren't just jumping on bandwagons.
There are a number of questions about WinStar. Who are the key people involved with WinStar Foundation? Can you expand about your activities and any other thing that you would like to add?
Thank you. The chairman of our board, I'm the president of WinStar. The chairman is Jay Hare, who's president of the National Wildlife Federation. We have created a partnership with those folks. We are doing the Aspen Global Change Institute, I think, is the major and most exciting thing. There's ongoing programs at WinStar. There are WinStar connection groups in, I believe, 18 or 19 cities around the United States now. There are several in Canada. There's one in Tokyo, Japan. There are a couple in Australia. And they're trying to start up in Europe and in the Soviet Union. And these are people, a grassroots movement, if you will, people in their communities who are looking for ways that they can make a difference and have been inspired by WinStar and what we have to say and what we're doing to take it home with them. And they're doing some great, great things. We have our annual Choices for the Future Symposium is the end of August this year. It's in Aspen, Colorado, where we talk about choices for a healthy environment. As I mentioned earlier, this thing about making conscious choices. You know, if you know, you can make a conscious choice. And more now, you can't pick up a magazine without there being environmental articles. We're now starting to see on products what products are environmentally safe. And so you have the chance to make those choices. You make choices every single day. Make choices for a healthy environment. Make choices for a sustainable future. Make choices for life.
If you could have a private conversation with President Bush, what would you say to him about his environmental policies?
Well, I happen to like President Bush a great deal, and I believe that he's sincere in what he says. I believe that he is being misguided in several places, and most pointedly, I would put a finger out at Mr. Sununu, to whom the environment is a bad word, to who, as far as I can tell, doesn't give a damn about the environment. And I find our president then in a very difficult position, you know, of contradiction there with his closest advisor. I would tell him that I think where he has an opportunity to go down in history and to be the man that I think he aspires to be and the president that he aspires to be would be to take a much stronger look at how important the environment is and to really take some action now to really provide a leadership role in our world, not to be the one that's dragging their feet. And then I'd have a whole bunch of other people talk to him who'd have more to say than I do.
Where have you found your message of environmental responsibility to be the best received? Where the questions
put. Truly with young people. It's very exciting to me the number of young people who have come to WinStar, who come to our Choices program, and who then go back to their parents. The letters that I get from parents whose kids have gotten them started recycling, or gotten them to stop smoking, or gotten them to look at how much grain is cost to make a pound of beef. And it's what makes me think, or know, I guess, that thing that we all know in our hearts, that the children are the future, and we have to put them in touch with what's going on, both, you know, the things that we know and the things that we don't know, our fears and our uncertainties just as well, and allow them to see our humanness, if you will, and in that to recognize their own potential.
As teachers, we try to do an adequate job of teaching environmental protection in our schools. My question is, how can school-aged children get your message? Have you authored environmental tapes or videos?
Yes, we have tons of them, and if you'll see me afterwards, I'll try to get you in touch with WinStar and all that we have available, and all of the things that other folks are doing. One of the things that we try to do at WinStar is, everybody is not about the whole environment. Some people like the ocean, and I put them in touch with Jacques Cousteau, and some people like the wilderness and wildlife, and I put them in touch with the National Wildlife Federation. Some people like dolphins, and there's somebody else, and there's somebody else about the rivers. So whatever your inclination, one of the problems that I think we have and one of the things that young people get is the enormity of it all, and it's like it's so big that how can we possibly do anything, and so why even try? And what I always tell the young people, you know, you don't have to do everything, because there are a lot of us. But if each of us does something, you know, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. Do what you can do. Follow your own inclinations, your own interests. One thing I ask everybody, pick up a piece of litter every day. It's not hard to find, folks. It's out there everywhere. Make it a point. Make it a point to reach down and pick up a piece of litter and put it in a trash can someplace. And you know what? You'll be an inspiration for other people to do that. And also, it will help if you can make that a commitment. What happens for me is every day I look for stuff to pick up, and I do that. Don't say anything about it, but I remind myself that I am committed to a better world and a better way of life, a better quality of life. I want my children to enjoy the same things that I enjoy. I want my grandchildren to be able to enjoy the Rocky Mountains and to go fishing in a clean stream and eat the fish they catch if they want to or throw them back. I want that desperately. I think it's just so, so important. And you tell that to young people. And then be the example. Bring the things that you can, whatever age group you're teaching. More and more, there are learning materials out there for young people to hands-on experience. You know, get in touch with the earth. I think there are people, young kids in New York and probably in the ghettos around our country who think that milk comes from cartons. Don't know cows. And who've never seen the stars. Never seen the stars. Can you see the Milky Way here in San Francisco? No? It's the most glorious sight in the world. You know, it's astronomy. Here's another way to get in touch with kids. We're all excited about the eclipse. There's a place that I can point out in the summer sky where there is called a globular cluster. And in this cluster, which cannot be seen with the naked eye, there are over 1 million stars. 1 million stars. And when you look at it through a telescope, you see this little hazy blob. And all of a sudden, as you continue to look, you see that it's points of light. 1 million stars. And you can't see it. And it's in our galaxy. When I talk to kids about my telescope, everything that I can show you in the sky, including this place where there are 1 million stars, it's in our galaxy. And now I'm going to show you another galaxy. And you don't need a telescope for this. You would here in San Francisco. But out in the mountains or out in the ocean, you can look up and there's a place called Andromeda. And it's 2.2 million light years away. And there are billions, how does Carl Sagan say it? Billions and billions of stars in that galaxy, and you can see it with your naked eye. And then you point that out to them. And do you know that there are billions of galaxies? What is out there? What awaits us in this final frontier? Hi, I think it's just the beginning.
A little housekeeping here. There is one question about how one might get a copy of your poem. Another teacher asking for a copy of the poem. So if you have that information, you might share it with people. And then how people might, whom they might contact to work with your foundation. If you could share those.
Well, the poem, you can write my office in Aspen, box 1587, Aspen, Colorado. If you get it to Colorado, it'll get to me. I get mail from around the world, John Denver, Rocky Mountains, USA, and it gets to me. So, but it's box 1587 to make it a little bit easier on the post office. And I'd be very happy to send you a copy of the poem. And for Windstar, doggone it, I can't think of the box number to save my life right now. But if you write to me, I'll put you in touch with Windstar and get you whatever information you'd like. We'd love you to be a member of the Windstar Foundation.
I've read that one of your mottos is conservation begins in our own backyards. To that end, are fines the best means of inducing Americans to take recycling more seriously?
Well, I don't know. You know, I'd like to see whatever it takes to get people, you know, to take greater responsibility. I find that one of the things that's happening more and more everywhere is people are recycling. And I think the community makes that possible. I know I was very proud of Aspen a couple years ago. At all the restaurants on the mountain, on all four mountains in Aspen, there's one garbage can for paper and stuff and one for glass and one for tin cans, and so we're starting to do that in a much greater level, and it can be done everywhere. I love the fact that here in California you have $1,000 fine for littering. I love that. We'll stop throwing garbage around. You know, I think one of the signs of a people and where they stand is what kind of room they live in, which is a terrible thing for me to say in the mess that's in my office, but we're surrounding ourselves with garbage. It's everywhere we go. I was on Michigan Avenue in Chicago a little over a year ago, and as many people as there were there, if each one of them at one moment, like if we could have that, a bell ring every once in a while and everybody reached down and picked up a piece of litter, it would be sparkling out there. But unfortunately, that's not happening yet.
What do you see in the future as far as alternative energy sources to replace our dependence on oil is concerned? And two, what is your opinion of the possibility of oil development in the Alaska Wildlife Refuge?
Well, I don't feel very well about that. You know, I was one of the ones who argued very strongly and loudly against the Alaska pipeline, concerned about problems, concerned about impact on the environment, and more importantly, stressing the value of this wilderness for us. I was reading the paper yesterday or the day before how there's a lot of new insight coming forward, really at the expense of the jobs of a lot of loggers, but there is actually more income from the recreational use and the recreational value of wilderness and forests than we're getting from the lumber in it right now. And we have to wake up to that. The Alaska pipeline, you know, I was incensed and still am that the Exxon Valdez ran aground on Bly Reef. It should never have happened. And the damage is still there, regardless of what they say and regardless of what Exxon tells you. You know, their biggest bunch of liars that I know in the world today is the oil people. And I'll tell you one of the things that made me angriest, what was put in place after this accident. A check for alcohol for the crew within an hour of their departure. A speed limit out of the channel. Do you know that when one of these however many tons yachts loses its engine, oil tankers, it takes them 25 miles to stop? 25 miles. So we gave them a speed limit. Don't we have speed limits in the air. How come it took the spillage of all of that oil to get them to get a speed limit? And the third thing is they have a tanker escort to take them all the way out of Prince William Sound now. A tanker that is capable, if a ship loses its power, pull them out of the traffic lanes to contain a small oil spill very immediately should it happen. And you know what the total cost of this is? 7 cents a barrel. 7 cents of the cost of a barrel of Alaskan oil. And it took the Exxon Valdez for us to get that to happen. And they're not going to pay it anyway. We're the ones who are paying it. Do you know that in 1988 dollars, Exxon made $5.2 billion in profit, which is $10,000 a minute for a year? That's the profit they're making. And we have asked them time and time again. Jay Hare goes to the Exxon a board meeting to ask them to take certain environmental precautions, like double-hulled tankers, and they refuse every single one. Mr. Rawl, the chairman of Exxon, made $9 million that year in salary and perks. I don't like him very much. You know, and we let him get away with it, you and I. Well, I hope, you know, we've got to start taking responsibility for that, too.
Please comment on population explosion and environmental concerns.
Well, as population is obviously a factor, and my involvement in the world hunger issue has to do with population also. Several things that we've learned. One, in regard to the issue of hunger, we actually produce in this planet enough to feed twice its population. There are not too many people. Africa has the potential to feed not only itself, but all of Europe. Zimbabwe, a couple of years ago, was a grain importer. In the last couple of years, they have produced not only enough to feed themselves, but to export over 1,000 tons of grain and to put 1,000 tons of grain in storage. India, which we thought was going to be the breadbasket of the world back in the 1970s, is now feeding itself. They haven't gone. China. China has created the most sustainable population base and production food base in the world today. They produce what they consume. However, they have an enormous problem environmentally with the pollution in that country. And we've got to get with them, not shut them out, not be away from them, but get with them to start dealing with these environmental problems. We have to get with Europe. How come we can't support what's going on in Eastern Europe to a much better degree? How come we can't support Mr. Gorbachev and what he's trying to accomplish in that country in a much stronger way? You know, they have more oil than anybody in the world, Why don't we buy oil from them? How come we can't? Well, actually, it's starting to happen now. But 2 years ago, when I wanted to fly in space with the Soviets, it was against the law for us to even talk about an American astronaut going with the Soviets. They were concerned about the transfer of technology, sharing technology. So population, I get off wandering, I guess. Again, to a large degree, it's education. You know, so much of what's going on, the depletion of the rainforest in South America is because of people who are trying to go out there and farm land or raise cattle. And mostly it's raise cattle, not farm. And so they're chopping down the forest. And we have to educate ourselves and find a way to balance all of these things. You know, I wonder what a global community really looks like and how you make use of it, where there are the people who have the management skills, what they do, where the workforce is, and where you take advantage of that, like so many things that are made in Hong Kong or Taiwan. You know, what a wonderful opportunity to really make that start to work. There's a program that Buckminster Fuller, who was a dear friend of mine, designed called Genie, Global Energy Network. And what he wanted to do was have, while we're using energy, it's nighttime over in the Soviet Union, they don't need it. And then as the world spins around, we'll get, and so you keep the energy moving around. It's a far out idea. I mean, far out.
Unfortunately, we have time for just one last question. I apologize to those of you whose questions I could not get to. And that is this. Where can this little old great-grandma sign up for the first settlement in space as long as you go along?
Is that you? Well, thank you very, very much. And I'll give you my ticket. Or when I get one, I'll buy two. I'd love to go in space. My father was a pilot. I love to fly. I would give anything to be able to look back at this beautiful blue jewel that hangs in the blackness of space that is our spaceship. You know, there's no passengers on Spaceship Earth, Bucky used to say. We're all crew members. And I would give anything to do that. But I truly believe, more importantly, that there's something that can be done there. In the way that I described, and maybe there's other ways, and maybe there's somebody better able to do it, but there is a way through the peaceful exploration of space to really catalyze young people into making a commitment to make a contribution to a better life. And I think it's desperately needed, and will work for that with every ounce of energy in my body. I appreciate so much having the chance to share these few thoughts with you folks. It's a real scary thing. You said it's people's biggest
phobia,
public speaking, and I can verify that. But I always love it when I get to go out and walk on fire, and I thank you for that opportunity today.
Thank you.
Our thanks to singer-songwriter John Denver for speaking to us today. Please join us again next week when our speaker will be John Sawhill, President and CEO of the Nature Conservancy, who will discuss environmental issues for the 1990s. Thank you all for attending today's luncheon. This meeting now stands adjourned.